Hello, this is episode number 25 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, August 16th, 2007. I'm your host, Adam Thier of the Progress and Freedom Foundation. Earlier this month, in the wake of the University of California study revealing serious security weaknesses in touchscreen voting machines, California's Secretary of State decertified the state's electronic voting machines and then recertified them with added security restrictions. And last month, Florida released a security analysis of Diebold's voting software and found that the company had still failed to fix security problems identified in earlier reviews of the system. Joining us this week to discuss this issue is Tim Lee of the Cato Institute. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Adam.
And we're also joined by a very special guest this week, Ed Felton, who is a professor of computer science at Princeton University. Welcome, Professor Felton.
Hi, Adam. Hi.
Professor Felton, let's start with you. Last fall, your research team conducted one of the first hands-on security reviews of the Diebold's touchscreen voting machines. What did your report say, and how concerned should we be as voters about our votes counting with computerized voting machines?
Well, what we said, what the report said in a few words, is that the Diebold voting machine we studied was nowhere near secure enough to give us confidence in the elections that used it. We found all kinds of security problems. We found that the voting machines could catch computer viruses. On the whole, along with other studies that have been done, this all painted a pretty bleak picture about the security of electronic voting.
Just to play devil's advocate, I mean, aren't there flaws with other types of voting systems, including paper-based voting systems? I mean, why should we rule out the use of e-voting in the future? Isn't it our future?
Well, I don't think we should rule out the use of e-voting. The question is really what kind of safeguards do we have in place? And, of course, it's true that we've fought election fraud for a long time in different forms of election, with paper, with mechanical lever voting machines, and so on. But I think what's different about electronic machines is, first of all, that they're less transparent to the voter and even to the poll worker. It's less obvious what's happening inside the machine. And second, there are kinds of failures that can happen with electronic voting that don't really have analogs in the old system. If, for example, if there is bad software in the voting machine, that bad software may be everywhere. It may be at every voting machine in a county or a whole state. And the result could be a systematic error of the kind that's not likely to happen with other systems. And so we're worried about these new threats.
Now, what do you say, though, to responses like those that came forward after the California report was released that said that the security flaws were unrealistic because the hacks that they found weren't carried out in sort of a real-world scenario where there might be people around monitoring the actual process? What do you say to that sort of a criticism?
It is something that needs to be taken into account, but the better security studies, including the ones done in the California study, do take into account these sorts of issues. One of the things that happens in practice is that the voting machines, although they may be out in the open and visible on election day, before election day and after election day, they're often very exposed. In my own precinct here in Princeton, New Jersey, it's routine to have the voting machine sit unattended overnight the night before the election. Anybody could walk up to them, and in fact, I make a practice of going there and seeing, again, the voting machines are unattended. And when they're unattended, then there really is a much higher risk. So I think in practice, the procedures aren't always followed the way that that some people would have you believe.
I also think that sort of criticism is really misguided, because the whole point of a security review or any sort of security analysis is to think about the worst case scenarios and assume that you've got, you know, a clever and determined person who's looking for vulnerabilities. And I mean, obviously, in any given election, most voting machines aren't going to be exploited, but you don't need to have, you know, you only need to have one person find one security vulnerability to change the outcome of an election. So the fact that it's maybe a little bit difficult to exploit these sorts of vulnerabilities really isn't, I don't think that's really a reason to dismiss or minimize the importance of these flaws.
We rely a lot in our election system on poll workers who are volunteers. And of course, that's a good aspect of the system we have, but it does mean that someone who has ill intent can get a job as a poll worker. They can sign up and they can get the kind of access that even ordinary voters don't have. So we need to be aware of these risks. We can't be in a situation where any volunteer poll worker can cause havoc.
Tim, let me ask you, you've been doing some writing about this issue on the Tech Liberation Front blog, and specifically you've been discussing the legislation that's currently being considered before Congress on this front. Why don't you explain to our, for our listeners what that legislation would do and what the effects of that bill would be on election security?
Sure. Well, the legislation is sponsored by Representative Rush Holt, who I believe is Professor Felton's representative in New Jersey. And it would do several important things. The most important thing from my perspective is that it would prohibit the use of touchscreen voting machines that did not produce a voter-verified paper trail. So right now you have voting machines where the voter votes. It just displays what the vote was on the screen, and then the voter walks away. And if there were malicious software on the machine, it could display one outcome and then record a different one in its memory card. And so the whole legislation would require that the machine produce a paper record of the vote that that the voter could look at and verify before leaving the polling place. Then the other I think most important step is requiring hand recounts of the voter verified paper trails. Depending on how close the election is, I believe it requires between 3% and 10% of the voter verified paper ballots to be counted and by hand and compared with the official results. And there's two reasons for that. I think one is just in general to double check the accuracy of the electronic machines, and the other I think is to make sure that the paper trails are in fact taken seriously by poll workers, because if the poll workers use the electronic count as their initial count, they might treat the paper trail as sort of an afterthought, and then that sort of defeats the purpose, because if voters and poll workers aren't taking it seriously, it's not going to be a reliable record of how the election came out.
But let me just be clear on this. The Holt bill would not therefore be an outright ban at this point on electronic voting machines. It essentially is trying to tinker with the existing system. Professor Felton, let me ask you, why, if there are so many flaws with the existing system, wouldn't we want to just ban it outright as opposed to tinkering with it like the Holt bill proposes?
Well, there are advantages to electronic voting. For example, if you do it right, voters may have a lower error rate. They may be less likely to, say, accidentally mark their ballot for two candidates and therefore spoil their ballot. You can present the ballot in big print for people who need that. You can present it in an audio form for people who have difficulty seeing, and so on. So that's certainly one set of advantages. Another advantage is that there are benefits to having an electronic record and a paper record side by side. In a sense, the two kinds of records are backstopping each other, so that if there's an error in either one, the other one will help you detect it and deal with it. So I think it's not the right approach to throw out electronics and computers entirely in voting. It's just that you need to have this safeguard of a voter-verified paper record, and you need to actually, as Tim said, take that paper record seriously.
Isn't that going to be an inherent tension if we envision going forward, if you have a lot of precincts that have electronic machines with paper records? Isn't it going to be kind of a struggle to get to make sure that both of those records are taken seriously? Because if one of them is neglected, it's almost worse than not having it at all, because it creates confusion with the elections without the sorts of safeguards you need to ensure that both records are actually reliable.
Sure. I think what ends up happening in practice is that you, election day ends, you quickly collate the electronic records, and then you do this sort of random audit or check that looks at the paper records in some places and compares them against the electronic. I think that's the likely outcome. And as long as people know that this comparison is going to happen with some likelihood, and that if there's a difference, then the cause will be investigated, I think people will take both records seriously. Certainly it is a concern, and you can talk about what kind of procedures you need in detail to make this happen in the right way. But this, I think, is where we're likely to go in any case moving forward. Whether the Holt bill passes or not, even in advance of the passage of this bill, there's been movement toward this sort of hybrid paper and electronic voting in a lot of states.
Can I ask a question about that? How differing models that might be out there at the state level, and the question of whether or not this should be up to state officials to experiment with on their own, as opposed to centralizing this at the federal level. What sort of tensions are there? Because I know there's always differences state by state in terms of how elections work.
Sure, this is an ongoing issue. Elections are administered by the states, and for elections within a state, it's obviously up to that state what to do. The federal government can establish some standards that apply to federal elections, and in practice, because states don't want to have two sets of equipment and two sets of procedures for state versus federal elections, they end up with this sort of hybrid of federal and state rules. The approach thus far has been to have sort of standards at the federal level, sort of minimum standards, and then states, and even within most states, individual counties make decisions about how they want to proceed. So in a lot of states, including California, where this most recent study was done, different counties use different systems, and you have this kind of patchwork even within the same state. There are only a few states where this is even done at the state level.
I do worry a little bit about, if you read the Hope Bill, it seems like every revision I've seen has gotten a little bit thicker and more complicated than the previous one. And I do worry about the Hope Bill does set up a fairly complicated apparatus where I believe it's the Election Assistance Commission. Anyway, maybe it's the National Institutes of Standards and Technology. Anyway, one of the bureaucracies is charged with conducting tests of all these machines, and there's a fairly elaborate ESCO process, which I think if you're going to have electronic voting machines, it's useful to have some of that oversight. But I do wonder whether creating a bureaucracy like that will create sort of an internal lobby for ever more complex electronic voting machines for the bureaucrats to study and certify, and whether it wouldn't be simpler to have simpler voting machines or to go back to paper machines, so you don't have to have this complicated federal process.
Certainly, you see this kind of trade-off, and one of the real challenges we've seen is that the decision makers, especially at the county level, often don't have the technical expertise available to them to make some of the judgments that they need to make in order to get good machines. And so they've relied to some extent on the federal certification process, which has not worked all that well up to now. The federal certification process has been complicated, but not very effective. And I think the Hope Bill is trying to improve that, but I share Tim's concern that it does seem awfully complicated. And certainly we'd like to move in the direction where you don't need to be a technical genius to understand whether your voting machine is working right.
Are there any international experiences here or case studies that we can draw any lessons from, or is this really something America's blazing the trail on?
There have been electronic voting issues in other countries. There have been controversies about this issue in Ireland, in the Netherlands, and so on. In other countries, it tends to be done, the decisions tend to be made at the national level. And obviously, it's hard to generalize. I think many of the issues that have arisen in the U.S. have also come up in other places. We have our own distinctive politics that leads the process in a different direction. There are some countries that are perfectly happy with paper-based voting, where voters fill out a piece of paper and drop it in a ballot box, and at the end of the night you dump it on a table and the poll workers just count it. One of the things actually that's distinctive about American elections is we tend to have a lot more issues on the ballot compared to other places. You have federal races, you have state races, you have county races and town or city races, you have constitutional amendments and referenda and so on. And it's not that it's relatively common to have 50 or more issues on the ballot, which leads to a lot of complexity and makes all of this more difficult than a place where you just say vote for one member of parliament.
Let me ask a question of Professor Felton, that since he's a security researcher, that he might have some specific insight in. One of the provisions of the original version of the Hope Bill was that effectively the voting machine source code had to be made publicly available for anybody to inspect. And as I recall, the more recent versions have a more complicated procedure where the vendors are allowed to require security researchers to sign non-disclosure agreements that have various conditions attached to them. Are you at all concerned about those restrictions, and do you feel like that'll Will you be worried about signing those NDAs or that that'll impede your work at all?
I am worried about this issue, and it all comes down to what's in that non-disclosure agreement. Obviously, we're not interested in promoting election fraud, and we're not interested in trying to steal the intellectual property of the election company. But we do feel that it's important that there be some transparency in this process. And if citizens are not allowed to know the details of how their votes are counted, it seems like something is wrong. I am concerned, but I think it's maybe cautiously optimistic as to how this will come out. If security researchers like me and my colleagues at other institutions are able to actually do meaningful studies of these systems, I think we can make a lot of progress in understanding how good the system is and how we're doing at making progress. It's been a real struggle over the last decade or so to get access to technical details about electronic voting machines. Fortunately, we have managed to pry a lot of this process open. But the Hope Bill certainly could help us do that further.
Am I right that you're not at liberty to say where you got the Diebold machine that you used as the basis of your study last year?
Right. What we can say is that we got it from a private party, and the party who gave it to us asked us not to identify them. We were the first independent researchers to get full access, full physical access to a voting machine, even though the whole research community had for at least 5 years been trying. So it was really a lucky break that we got the access that we did.
I'd like to ask one other question. I hope it doesn't sound too silly, but what does the future hold in terms of electronic or digital voting? I mean, we live in an era when you can use your cell phone to vote for your favorite American Idol contestant, and a lot of people in this country, I mean, I hate to generalize, are probably so damn lazy they might think, why can't I just vote from my phone for my favorite candidate for office? And you know, there are a lot of good reasons, security and otherwise, why we don't want to do that. But isn't it also the case that, you know, should we really make it that easy for people to vote? I mean, shouldn't people have to go somewhere and cast a vote, maybe downtown hall or a courthouse or something? It seems to me like that's just part of a democracy, is you have to actually get out and go somewhere to vote.
Well, certainly there is something to be said for stepping out of your ordinary routine in order to sort of take a pause and vote, to treat it as an important event. There are also good reasons to want to get people into a private voting booth to cast their vote there. You know, historically, that's been a place where you can go, where you have autonomy to vote the way you want. There's nobody looking over your shoulder. There can be nobody looking over your shoulder when you vote. And so you're free to vote your conscience. And when you move voting out into the home, when you move it out into the street corner, you start to erode that moment of privacy that's an important part of the experience.
Let me ask about the one other one other big compromise that's been incorporated in the Hope Bill, which is this provision that says that paper tape printers are acceptable in 2008 and 2010. Do you have any sense for the extent to which that will undermine the overall goal of the Hope Bill? And in particular, do you think that it will be able to preserve the anonymity of votes? Because that's one of the other requirements that the Hope Bill requires, that you not be able to reconstruct who voted for which candidate.
Right.
Do you think that will be, or are you concerned about the thermal printer provision in that respect?
Right. So just to elaborate a little bit on this issue, some of the voting machines that have, that keep paper trails, keep them on a continuous roll of paper, kind of like a cash register tape, except that they don't break off. They don't tear off the strip for each voter. And the result of that is that the votes are on the roll at the end of the day in the order in which they were cast. So you can associate those votes with the voters, because in most polling places, they keep track of who showed up in what order. This is something that, as Tim said, the Hope Bill will ban, but that ban won't take effect immediately. And this is, again, a compromise. It takes a while. Once you decide that you want to upgrade the voting equipment, it takes a while for it to actually happen. The new equipment needs to be certified through whatever federal or state certification process goes on. You need time to buy it. You need time to train the poll workers and all of that. And there were concerns that it wouldn't be possible to switch right away. This has been one of the constant debates in the legislation, how soon will these requirements take effect. And I think it's reasonable to say, I think it's pretty clear by now that we're not going to fix this problem for the 2008 election. We're looking now to 2010 and 2012. And that's, I think, the reality that the whole bill is recognizing in this provision. I do think it's important to keep our eye on the ball of this issue of voter privacy. But so I'm not so worried about this. I think in the long run, we're going to end up in the right place.
The other thing I'm really worried about with that provision is that in 2008, you'll have some states that rush these these cheap printers into production, and then there's going to be some sort of disaster, and people say, well, see, paper trails don't work. It's the whole bill's fault that our election was such a disaster. And I almost feel like they should have just exempted 2008 entirely from if they weren't going to require the paper trail and the durable paper trail in 2008, they should have just exempted it entirely and focused on 2010.
Well, sure. States are and counties are in a bit of an unhappy situation now. A lot of them know that the equipment they have is really not good and is going to have to be scrapped. But if they don't know what they need to get for the future, they're sort of stuck. And you don't want a state or county to have to go out and buy something which doesn't work very well and then use it once or twice and then move on to buy the thing that they're really going to need. So certainly, if that's the outcome, you prefer to avoid that. I think all of this is going to continue to be negotiated if the bill moves forward. And the outcome that you suggested, that these requirements are just put off entirely for a few years, it seems like a likely compromise.
Well, that's going to do it for Tech Policy Weekly this week. I want to thank Ed Felton and Tim Lee for joining me. And to read more commentary from the entire Technology Liberation Front gang, please visit us at techliberation.com. Also, if you'd like to comment about something you heard on today's show, you can post a comment on the website. Just go to technologyliberation.com/podcast, and you can leave a comment on the page for this show. If you liked what you heard, please tell a friend. Please write a review of the show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Adam Thier. See you then.